supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later on the show, we're always talking about using ornamental grasses for privacy and screening plants. But there's a couple of conditions, a couple of warnings we should tell you about, how to help prevent them from becoming invasive problems, and a little fine detail about the types of blades these grasses have. We'll tell you all about it after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you today, Mike?
I am just ducky. Actually, I have no voice left. I'm still screaming from the flower show and all the events around it, you know, so, you know.
Very good.
Yeah, a month or so, I think I'll be back, you know.
Great.
How are you, Steve?
I am doing fine. I am in National Park, New Jersey. I don't know if you're familiar.
It's, no.
Right next to the Red Bank Battlefield. It's a revolutionary site there, and I live on the river, and right across the river is the Navy Yard, Philadelphia Navy Yard.
All right. What can we do for you, Steve?
I've been working for the last three seasons on trying to get some kiwis growing. I did buy them at a large box store. I have a male and I have a female, so the label told me. The last three seasons, I haven't really done any hard pruning. And it looks like in the spring, I'll get, like, it looks like a bud, but it never flowers. And then they just drop off. And I don't know what I'm going to do with this, or should I prune that back hard so maybe the roots can develop a little bit better and get stronger?
Now, I'm presuming you can still identify the vine that you think is male and the vine that you think is female?
No, at this point, I'm not quite sure. I have them separated about 10 to 12 foot apart, at which they do marry into each other.
Right.
And I know they grow because I've been down to Longwood Gardens and I've seen them.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. No, there's no issue about you growing hardy kiwi in your climate. Give them good support because they are tenacious plants. They'll pull down an unstable arbor. Now, the plant should look different. The flower buds should appear only on the female plants, with the pollen producing parts only on the male plants.
Right.
So have you seen that the plants look really different right before you see those buds? Are the buds just on one plant?
I'm thinking the buds are just on one plant, yes.
And how much sun do they get?
I'd say during the growing season, they're getting at least 6 hours, 7 hours of pretty good light.
Hmm. Starting around when and ending around when? Be honest.
I'm going to say around 10 to 11 to about 4.
You're right at the minimum for fruiting plants. They really want 6 to 8. Are you feeding them anything?
I have not fed them anything yet.
And you haven't really pruned them?
Well, I just whacked them down about a month ago.
Oh, any special reason?
I'm just thinking to myself, well, it's been three seasons. I haven't gotten anything yet. So I think if I cut them down hard, maybe it'll help them root system to strengthen. I know it's done that with wisteria before. You'll cut them back and then it'll help them to flower. I don't know.
One issue is sun. They might not be getting enough sun. Another issue is mislabeling. You really got to look at the plants. Go online, get a good article from a reputable university on hardy kiwi, and look at the illustrations of the male plant and the female plant, and make sure that you do indeed have one of each, because the females need a male for pollination. Yeah. Once you've identified which vine is the male and which one is the female, mark them so you don't forget.
Right.
Because in the future, yes, you want to be pruning the female back hard, but you want the male to grow fairly vigorously because you want it to produce as much pollen as possible.
Okay.
Give it a good feeding. I would shovel 3-4 inches of real high quality compost down around the base of the plants. These things are heavy feeders. I wouldn't even hesitate to get a packaged organic fertilizer with low NPK numbers that's labeled for use in fruit or flowering plants, and apply a good amount of that, and then cover that with soil or compost to make it bioavailable. And then stay online and read the pruning instructions at the university websites. You are not incorrect in that hardy kiwi often needs multiple prunings a year. Now, some plants don't. Some plants are just in the right conditions, are going to produce fruits right away. But as you noted with wisteria, sometimes these kind of very woody vines do need to be beaten back a couple of times. So give them a good feeding. Anything you can do to give them more light. If there's something you can move out of the way, a shrub you can tear down. But a good feeding and read up on the pruning. And then examine these plants carefully in late spring when the different sexual parts should appear. And make sure you got one of each. Don't just trust labels.
Well, I really appreciate your advice, and then I hope I get some kiwis.
Good luck, Steve. Take care, man.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Robert, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Robert. How you doing, man?
I'm hanging in there, you know.
I hear that. I hear that. Where are you hanging in?
Yardley, PA.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Robert in Yardley?
I've got a bunch of hydrangeas that refuse to bloom, and I suspect that it's because they're being improperly trimmed at the end of every season. So I'm wondering, what's the best way to manage these and handle them? When do they get pruned and how far down and all that good stuff?
Well, gee, Robert, who's sneaking into your yard and doing this improper pruning every fall?
Well, I have a gardener, yard man, whatever you want to call it, that comes and does the spring and fall cleanup, and he sneaks in there when I'm at work making the money to pay him, and manages to trim them probably too far down and at the wrong time, I'm probably suspecting.
Yes, no plant should be pruned in the fall. You know, and it's funny, I did a talk at the Philadelphia Flower Show a couple of weeks ago, and the exact same thing. It was two people. One was a landscaper coming in doing this. One was a, quote, friend helping them out. And there's just something about putting pruners in the hands of a man in fall where no plant has a chance, where every plant is under threat of death. Nothing should ever be pruned in the fall. Fall pruning is an act of total boredom. If you see yourself walking out with pruners anytime between June and the dead of winter, go back inside and turn on the TV. Watch football. Watch the World Series. Leave the darn plants alone. All plants need their full biomass to survive winter. First of all, pruning stimulates new growth. New growth at that time of year is prone to freezing at the first hard frost we get, whereby if you leave the plant alone, it's going to naturally send all its energy down to the root system, go dormant. All of its moisture, all of its energy is going to be safely underground, and it can handle winter. When you prune a plant in the fall, you make it use up some of that energy. You slap it awake. You make those leaves or branches or whatever full of sap, much more moisture-filled than they were before, and totally prone to winter damage. There is not a single plant that should ever be touched in the fall.
So back to the original question, the hydrangeas. So this year I caught him in time and I said, no, don't touch, and got the message across.
Good.
And he merrily whacked everything else down, but the hydrangeas were left safe this year.
Yeah, you
so
do realize
they're full height with the canes, lost all their leaves.
Good. Yeah, that's
so
fine.
Now what do I do?
Okay, you do realize that if he pruned any spring blooming plants, they won't bloom in the spring now.
Azaleas, etc. Right.
Now hydrangeas are very interesting plants. Sometimes some species bloom on what's called old wood. It had to be there for a year or two. Some species bloom on new wood, only the new stuff that comes up fresh every spring. Some species, however, seem to be able to cross over depending on weather conditions. So there's only one safe way to prune hydrangeas, and that's to do the hardest thing for any gardener. Just leave them alone. Just don't touch them. Wait until we get to late spring, early summer, when they put on their flowers, right? The little flower buds start to open up. You see where all the new blooms are going to be. Then, when you're pretty sure all the flowers are set and they're starting to open, you can go out and remove all of the non-blooming canes that you want. Okay. All of the branches that don't have flowers on them, remove any of the ones that are in front of the flowers. Don't remove them all, but do feel free to remove any that are blocking the flowers. That's the only way you can prune hydrangeas and make sure you're not preventing flowers. Wait till the flowers appear, but then you can remove a good third of the non-flowering branches, and the plant will look dramatically fuller. It'll look like there's three times as many flowers on it because there's nothing in their way.
Okay, well, that probably explains what I've been doing wrong all these years, because the things haven't bloomed in a number of years, and so I knew it was probably a pruning issue. I've heard you use that line a million times about how dangerous men are when they get pruners and they prune too much. So, obviously it's true.
Yeah. All right, but you got a plan now, Rob.
I do. I have a plan. I'll try and go out there and find some more problems. I'll call you back another time on it. I appreciate it.
All right. You're always welcome. Take care, man.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will give a brand new talk on the birds and the bees to benefit the scholarship program of the Optimist Club of Freehold, New Jersey, on Saturday, April 14th. Then I'll hop on over to the Haverford Home and Garden Show on Sunday, April 15th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with sharp brasses and even sharper phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com. And the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we will discuss the things you must consider before installing ornamental grasses, and or the things you must consider before you go out and prune them. In the meantime, more of your pruneful phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Reed, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well,
good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, Reed. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Vienna, Virginia.
Vienna, that's right near Wolf Trap, right?
That's true, yes.
All right, so what can we do for Reed in Vienna?
Last week I was grinding up my bells and papers in my home shredder. I had two or three bags full, and the thought occurred to me that rather than put it out into the people to take it away for recycling, I wondered how well those paper shreds might work around my vegetable plants next spring when I plant them, to put those papers down or the shreds down around the plants for weed control and perhaps no mulch?
Well, first of all, one of the things I like to tell people is if there's already a good stream available for using up waste material like this, we should use it. We have a big paper recycling center near where I live in the Lehigh Valley, and I always ask questions about what happens to stuff on the back end. And all of the old newspapers and shredded junk mail and old bills and stuff gets turned into one of the most important substances on the planet, Reed. Toilet paper, one of like the top five things we humans could not do without, right? You can run out of heating oil in the winter, but you better not run out of toilet paper during a snowstorm, you know.
Absolutely right.
So one of the other considerations is look at what you're grinding up. Most of this stuff has those little cellophane windows, and it's a mixture of different types of paper, different colors and stuff. Generally, when we talk about mulching against weeds in a vegetable garden, we talk about using, quote, organic mulches, things like shredded leaves. Shredded leaves are ideal. You know, in the mid-Atlantic where you live, in Virginia, Maryland, D.C., Pennsylvania, New Jersey, we all have so many deciduous trees and so many leaves in the fall. To shred those up and save those for the spring not only makes the perfect weed-suppressing mulch, but as the leaves break down, they add lots of nutrients to the soil, and you get the benefit of earthworms. When you mulch your plants with shredded leaves, that creates the natural cover that earthworms live under in the forest. So you don't have to do anything to bring worms to your garden other than to cover the soil with shredded leaves. You do that, go out a couple of weeks later, I don't care if it's day or night, dry or wet, move some of the leaf mulch away, and you'll see dozens of earthworms scrambling to get back under the soil. And those earthworms are taking your terrible clay soil and improving it. They're constantly churning it up and putting out worm castings, which are fertilizing your plants. So there's tremendous benefits for using fall leaves instead of paper. But I'm going to make an exception in your case. Obviously, we're going into the spring. People are getting their vegetable gardens ready, and not a lot of people saved up fall leaves that they either shredded in the fall or they can shred now. So if you want to be a separator, I would say that you could give it a try. Now, you're not going to add any nutrition to the soil with this mulch, but you should be able to keep weeds down with it. And it's a much better mulch than any kind of wood or bark or anything like that. So what I would want you to do is keep out all the stuff with the cellophane windows on the envelopes, because you don't want plastic out there. Don't use any of the slick material where they try to convince you to get a new credit card. But if you just take white paper envelopes, white paper flyers, things like that, and you can include some black and white newsprint in there, that would make a perfectly acceptable mulch. And what I would tell you to do is keep it no deeper than an inch or two. And when you apply it, wet it down so it doesn't blow away. That's a mulch that's not going to be really stable in dry and windy conditions. So when you water, make sure you keep the top of it wet, and it should stay in place. So I think that's perfectly acceptable. But my first choice, because I do the shredded leaves, is to send that stuff off to Markel to get toilet paper made for me.
Well, that's good advice. I appreciate that, and I'll give it a try.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thanks for the information.
All right. Good luck, Reed. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
1-888-346-9499. Shirley, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Hi, Shirley. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Shirley. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Atoka, Tennessee.
And what part of Tennessee is that? Is that near Nashville or Memphis?
It's about 30 miles north of Memphis.
Very good. What can we do for Shirley in Tennessee?
I have dollar wort that's taken over my yard. I live by a ditch and have had problems with it getting kind of high in the ditch, but that seems to be solved now. But I've been here 12 years almost. The first year or two, it wasn't very bad. It was right out there by the ditch, but it's just slowly taking over my whole yard, and I don't know what to do.
the weed that you're calling dollar wort, that sounds like a corruption. There's a very common weed that looks a little like water lilies, whose more common name is penny wort or dollar weed. But generally, I've not heard it called dollar wort. But I think we're talking about the same thing. It's a fleshy plant that you can tell is holding a lot of water.
Right, right.
See, this is a very common plant growing near water. It thrives in wet conditions, and it is almost invulnerable. I don't know if you've tried spraying with herbicides or digging it out or anything, but it is very tough to get rid of when it gets established. Now, it's always going to be around your little ditch or your creek or your stream, whatever you want to call it, but you should be able to keep it relegated to that area and out of your yard. In the areas where you don't want it, what do you have growing or what do you want to grow instead?
Well, it's just the lawn.
Okay, so do you feed the lawn?
No, I just do good to cut it.
Do you know what you have?
Ooh, I think it's Bermuda.
Okay, so it gets a little tan and dormant during the coldest part of the winter?
Yes.
And do you ever water your lawn, and how do you water it?
I usually don't.
Oh, okay. Do you know how high you cut it?
Well, I've been cutting it a little bit lower here lately. I use like 2 on my lawnmower.
Mm-hmm. Bermuda grass can be cut as low as 2 if you're not having problems. In this case where you wanted to outcompete a weed, especially in the summertime, I would raise the cutting height to 2.5. And don't trust the markings on your lawnmower. Make sure that that's how high the grass is after cutting. If you're not artificially watering the lawn, then your area of lawn has to be totally waterlogged. That area must drain poorly after a rain, or this plant couldn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I'm at the end of the street, and then I tend to get everybody's water.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what's going on. This is a plant that loves to grow in water, whereby your Bermuda grass is challenged by the water. You got to stop the water from coming down, whether that's building a low wall or a berm or having drain tiles installed to stop the water before it gets to your lawn and take it away. But I can tell you, as long as you're getting everybody else's water, you're going to have this pennywort as your ground cover, and it's only going to spread. Now, it is originally an ornamental plant that was planted deliberately in wet areas, and it thrives in wet areas. And as you see, it's green all year long, and it's a beautiful plant.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a couple things you can do. First, you got to stop this water from coming onto your yard, or you'll never beat this weed. Second, you should consider having somebody come in and aerate your lawn. That's where they pull big plugs out of the soil to improve the drainage. That'll help the grass and hinder the weed. With your warm season grass, you should be planning to core aerate in the late spring, early summer, when your grass is the strongest. Also, you can see where the pennywort, I'm pretty sure, is in a straight line and very dominant from the edge of your stream as it comes towards your lawn.
Right.
So I would pick that area, and I would drive in deep edging. Keep the stuff on the side of the stream. It's always going to be close to the stream. It's actually good to have it there by the stream because it's preventing erosion. It's keeping that ditch from getting wider. It's holding the soil in place. It's protecting you when you get a real flood. And then you can work on the rest of the lawn, which is going to be improving the drainage. That's going to have drain tiles installed. That's going to have a diversion built so the water doesn't wash down on your lawn every time it rains from the rest of the neighborhood, and core aeration done mm-hmm. in the late spring, early summer. The more you can open up that lawn, make it less compacted, the more you can keep water from coming off of it, the better you can control that weed. But leave it alone next to the stream. Just put in a barrier so it can't cross over anymore, and then slowly pick little areas, and you can hand pull those weeds out of the soil. Just do like 100 square feet at a time over the course of one summer, and you should be able to confine it to the other side of the fencing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good luck to you, Cheryl.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Robert, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, Mike, how you doing? This is Robert from Manhattan. That's Manhattan, New York City, not Kansas.
Excellent, excellent. What part of the city are you in?
I am very close to Union Square, and there's a wonderful market there with all kinds of vendors for food, cheeses, and plant material.
Okay.
I love going to those vendors. They have wonderful material to buy and whatever, but that's kind of the problem I have with that.
Okay. Proceed.
Now, yes, I will have to. I have a horticultural heating pad where I start my cuttings, where I start my seeds, where I grow and germinate all kinds of things. For instance, like I belong to the New York Gesneria Society, which is primarily known for African violets and gloxinias, and I'm growing seeds for them for their national show.
Okay, so you are a very advanced gardener when you're growing these African violets and their close relatives from seed, because most of the plants are vegetatively propagated.
Yes. And so this year I'm doing something which I haven't done before. I'm growing pansy seeds.
Very good.
But the pansy seeds are kind of lackadaisical. They're not doing much of anything. Basically, my question is, when do you sow pansy seeds?
Pansy seeds are very difficult. Most pansies are produced vegetatively. Most pansies are done via cuttings because, as you found out, the seeds are very temperamental. The fact that you got them to germinate is almost a mitzvah on your end. I presume you learned that they needed to be exposed to light to germinate as opposed to being buried under soil?
Actually, that's something you're telling me that I didn't know. I have everything under lights. I have, believe it, in a small Manhattan apartment, I have metal shelving with lights all over them. I must have like 90, 100 plants, orchids.
The most dedicated gardeners work in the most difficult conditions. Now, as you know, most seeds, they're exposed to light while we handle them, while we get them ready for planting, and then they prefer to have like a quarter inch of soil on top of them and to break through that. If you read the scientific research, pansies need to be laying on the surface of the soil. And then you kind of have to be watching them to see when something seems to change slightly, because then once you start to see a response from those tiny little seeds, then you're supposed to like literally just dust a tiny little bit of soil on top. Not enough to cover them, but enough to give them something to root into. So it's a long and laborious process. Now, as you know, pansies aren't going to do good in the summertime, either in New York or almost anywhere else. So I would urge you to simply baby these plants along, keep them inside. If you get any height off of them, then yes, you can take them outside in, say, May or June. But as we start to get to July, especially with the heat sink of Manhattan and the temperatures that tend to be generated in those concrete canyons, you really want to bring them back inside and baby them. Keep them under good light, but in a cool spot in your house. And then bring them back outside in September when everything else outside is starting to peter off. That's when these pansies should really explode. And again, thanks to the heat sink of the city, but the cool nights, your pansies should bloom from, say, September all the way through New Year's and perhaps even through the following spring. But then that's it. They're not true perennials. They're going to fade away. I guess in answer to your question, quite honestly, if you get them up in May and then you're growing them inside through June and July and August, then they'd be a good size to put out in September. And, man, they would give you a show all fall, winter, and spring. If you go to these garden centers, you see that there are as many pansy plants, live plants, available in the fall these days as there are in the spring.
Right. If I could just mention, I was speaking to one of the vendors this past week about his pansies that are blooming. And I said, when did you start the seeds? He said, I didn't start the seeds. I started by plug.
That's how virtually all the pansies sold in the United States are grown. I don't think anybody bothers with seed anymore. They're all grown vegetatively.
So I think I'm left to having to buy these market packs of beautiful blooming pansies then.
If you do buy them, my suggestion is to wait till late August, early September, and then grow those as your fall, winter, and spring plant. Then it's totally uninterrupted. If you buy them this spring and you put them outside, just realize they're going to be as dead as pea vines by July.
Yes, yes.
All right, Robert, I'm coming to see your apartment. I think it should look great.
I have pictures. I should put them on the internet.
Yeah, send them to us. We'll put them up.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
All right, thank you, Robert.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And now it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at a fundraiser for the Bayshore Center in Port Norris, New Jersey, on Thursday evening, April 26th, and at St. Paul's Episcopal Church's Environmental Fair in Exton, PA, on Saturday, May 12th. After that, it's Cortez, Colorado on May 19th and the legendary Chautauqua Institute in late July. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with sharp grasses and sharp phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in this stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll discuss ornamental grasses, how to keep certain types from becoming invasive, and how to protect yourself when you decide that a big, sharp ornamental grass needs to be cut back a little bit. We're also going to urge you to follow some timing on any cutting back that'll give you a very special show in the spring. In the meantime, some very special phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mr. McGrath. I listen to your show quite often, and I'm a novice at putting together a raised vegetable bed, and I have a couple questions.
Can I ask you a question first?
Go right ahead.
Where are you?
We are in Voorhees, New Jersey.
Okay, the Garden State. Proceed, Joanne.
Okay, I want to be very conscious about using the material that I use for a raised bed. And I had noticed that we found one, it was a polymer raised bed. Have you ever heard of a polymer bed?
Now, when you say bed, you mean the frames that go outside. Yeah,
correct.
That look like wood. Now, when it comes to raised bed frames, you have a bunch of choices. You can go into garden centers and home stores, and you can buy raised bed kits where the frames are made of cedar or redwood. I have some beds in my garden that are framed with Trex, which is a composite material made of recycled plastic mixed with recycled wood and then formed in the shape of lumber. It lasts forever. It's very sturdy. It looks and cuts and works just like lumber. But what I've been urging people to consider instead is pavers or some other form of stone. Now you're not bringing any plastic of any kind into the picture. The pavers, of course, will last forever. It's like building a house out of brick. And that way you can make the bed any length you want. You don't have to cut lumber. You don't have to worry about joining the corners. And you can make it any height you want. You're not limited to the actual height of the original lumber. And if you decide you don't like it or you want to move it or you want to expand it or you want to shorten it, it's like adult Legos. You just take it apart and put it back together again in a different shape.
So what you're saying, pavers are like we use on a patio,
yeah,
that type of paver.
Yeah, just stack them up. Matter of fact, if you've got pavers on the patio, maybe your raised beds can match those pavers. It'll look like you did it deliberately. As you know, that stone will heat up during the day. It'll actually absorb some heat on a sunny day, and it'll radiate that heat back into the soil at night, and it'll keep the roots of the plants warmer. A tremendous advantage in the spring and the fall when you want to get started a little early or extend the season a little later. You've got this passive solar thing going for you. Without more information, I can't tell you about the plastic lumber that you're looking at, about the leaching possibilities. All I can say is if you can get the company name or the brand name or a better description, you know, you can go online and read reviews about it and stuff. There have been plastic lumbers that have been made that are very good, that don't leach, that are very dense, that are, you know, very inert.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's others that, you know, are leaching plastic into the soil that are not good for you to handle. If you've got a kit and you want to try it, I would just urge you to research it in advance.
Yeah, I did look
online. If it's really cheap, I don't know, walk away.
Well, no, it's not cheap. But it's way less than a paver.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, why don't you price it against Trex or one of the other composites?
Yes, I will. I will look. And you have used the Trex. You feel that...
The landscape timber size. Yeah, there's been no leaching. I've been testing them constantly, and they work great in the garden.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, before you get confused by a lot of other things, go to the website, read the articles on raised beds. I do commend you on building raised beds. That is the right way to go. Read the articles. Do it right the first time. Don't cheap out. Don't feel like you know, just because those big bricks of peat moss are so inexpensive or you've got this garden soil. The whole point of a raised bed is we're avoiding your garden soil. So spend a little bit up front and you'll have a gardening system that'll work for you for many, many decades. My earliest raised beds are over 30 years old now and they're still producing great.
Great. Okay. I thank you very much for spending the time with me, Mr. McGrath. Thank you.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Steven, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm okay, Steve. How are you doing?
Doing all right. I was a first-time listener, actually, when I decided to call you.
And okay. Where are you, man?
Outside of Downingtown.
Oh, okay.
Pennsylvania.
Right, in the Philadelphia area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, what can we do for you, Steve?
So I had a question. I'm a avid, you know, tree fan, ornamentals and maples, and you know, my property is about an acre, and I have all different types of trees on it. And what I noticed this year that my Japanese maple didn't lose its leaves. It didn't even change colors. They just kind of shriveled up and stayed on the branch. And I've noticed, you know, I'm a field technician out in Chester County, so I've noticed that it's been that way with every Japanese maple that I've driven by this winter. I was wondering what could have caused that.
We had in our area, we had some really strange weather around the time the trees were trying to go dormant. I have had maybe 50 reports from the Philadelphia area, from the Washington, D.C. area, areas in between New York State, involving all types of maples, but very specifically Japanese maples that still have their leaves hanging on to them. I had some of the weirdest things ever happen in my garden. I went out, I think it was in October, and I see this big burst of color, and I'm trying to figure out, did, you know, some sign blow into my yard or something. And I see this huge forsythia is in full bloom. And I'm not saying like a couple of branches were yellow. The thing was yellow top to bottom. And then just like a day or two after that, we had a very early, very hard freeze. It went down to like 20. And man, this thing looked beyond sad. And it hasn't looked much better all winter. I'm really curious to see. I will be happy if it greens up in the spring. I don't expect much of a bloom. But
yeah, I mean, I have some forsythias in the backyard, but I've noticed, you know, the buds on my quince tree, they're budding okay. So, you know, I was kind of, you know, my early flowering trees, I was kind of wondering what would have, you know, how it would have impacted them as well. But they seem to be doing okay so far.
You know, trees drop their leaves for two reasons, one of which is to smother smaller plants on the forest floor. Leaves are bullies. That's why I tell people not to leave whole leaves lay on a lawn or on their flower beds, because whole leaves mat down like a tarp. One of their jobs in nature is to reduce competition so that the trees get all the water and nutrients and there aren't these other plants growing up threatening them. But the other thing is, as you probably know, is the tree wants to close down for the winter. It wants to send all its energy down to its root system, and it literally wants to close every part of its body up to retain the moisture that's inside. It doesn't want to be affected by the changes that occur over winter. So part of the leaf drop is just sealing off all those little parts of the tree where the leaves were. Climate change has taken us into unknown territory. You know, there are types of leaves that do persist on trees over winter, and then they drop off in the spring and they're replaced by the new growth. You know, that's really all we can hope for. The most important thing is don't try to help it. Don't try to pull the leaves off artificially. Don't do anything to feed it.
Okay.
If you see it struggling in the spring after everything is greening up, and you see this thing kind of in any kind of a struggling state, then maybe you can give a shot at some light pruning just to stimulate more growth. See what's left in that root ball underground. Just, you know, little haircut, just a couple of inches off every branch you can reach. And maybe that'll give it the push it needs. But no food or anything like that.
Okay. And when should I do the pruning?
After everything else in your yard has greened up. You know, especially if there's no signs of life from the maple. You know, the Japanese maples are not the hardiest trees. They're not the longest lived trees. They are beautiful. But they tend to be a little sketchy every once in a while.
Yeah, I was kind of concerned about that.
It is bad for a tree to hold deciduous leaves over the wintertime. There's nothing good about it. But we have to see what's left in your root ball. And if everything else is green and that tree hasn't changed, you got nothing to lose by giving it a pruning, getting the leaves off kind of artificially, and seeing if you can stimulate some growth. But literally wait until you'd be comfortable putting out tomatoes.
All right, got it. Cool. Well, I appreciate the time, man. I'm definitely going to be listening to you guys more often. I found it really exciting with everything that you were sharing with all the callers. So
glad to have you aboard, Steve.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Best practices for ornamental grasses. Beware of invasives and of sharp blades. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's question.
Well, Mike, this is something I deal with every year in my landscape, so I can't wait to hear what you recommend. We heard from Chris in Devon, PA, who writes, I checked the A to Z Garden Answer section of your website under grass, ornamental grass, and tall grass, and couldn't find an answer to my question. Is it okay, recommended, or forbidden to cut off the dead stems of ornamental grasses? If it is okay, when is the best time?
You know, it depends on what Chris means. Many of the most attractive and tallest of the ornamental grasses develop beautiful plumes that extend well above the actual grass blades, adding lots of extra height and what my old friend Martha Stewart used to call winter interest to the garden.
Let's say that that is what Chris means. Should they be cut back?
You know, not a simple answer. Those plumes could produce seeds, and if the seeds are viable, they could turn a beautiful screening plant into a bigger menace than the enchanted broomstick that Mickey battled in the Sorcerer's Apprentice sequence of Fantasia. Some types of pampas grass, for instance, can produce millions of seeds per plant each season.
Ah, but if you cut off the plumes before those seeds can mature,
then you're a responsible owner of an otherwise invasive plant.
But if you have one of the so-called sterile varieties, or a grass that needs a pollinator to create viable seed, and there's no pollinator nearby,
ah, then cutting removes the most beautiful part of the plant for no reason.
So, research well you must before you plant.
Hey, if you're going to be Yoda, I want to be Han Solo. I am so tired of all these emails we get that start out with, help me, Obi-Wan, help me, you're my only hope.
Sorry, but, you know, you look a lot more like the old guy. Now, let's entertain the possibility that Chris is asking about the entire plant. After all, there is this awful idea that you should, quote, clean up the garden in the fall by cutting everything back to the ground. And that's always a bad idea. Where does that even come from?
It comes from people with too much time on their hands and or who don't understand the difference between getting fall leaves off the lawn before they can smother it and murdering a magnificent 20-year-old rhododendron. Helpful hint, if you see your spouse going out to the garden anytime between June and the dead of winter with a pair of pruners or lopers, stage an immediate intervention.
So, I take it that would be a strong no to cutting the plants back hard in the fall.
The only thing that can achieve is to expose the plants to severe winter injury and/or death. And you'll miss the best show with grasses that go brown and dormant in the winter. When those grasses begin to grow again in the spring, you get this magnificent green glow down low that expands until it looks like a huge glowing light in the center of the otherwise browned out plant.
And then you can prune off some of the previous growth if you want to keep the plant a certain size, or you need brown material for your compost pile, or if you want to prevent the buildup of fire hazardous materials. Like that time you were on vacation and...
Hey, whoa, what happens in Pungo stays in Pungo. All right, come on, cue the second question.
I don't know, I heard the flames went way over the top of the house.
Second question.
Okay, what a grouch. RC in Newark, Delaware writes, I have heard you recommend tall grasses for privacy and general landscaping. I wanted to mention that some tall grasses can be vicious. I used one around my built-in pool for decoration but had to dig it out after 2 years because the grass blades were so sharp that anyone touching a blade got the equivalent of a bad paper cut. Even walking too close past the grass with bare legs was dangerous. I would caution that people be aware of this fact when selecting a grass. You know, I heard you got pretty torn up trying to get rid of that burnt blade evidence after your big ornamental grass adventure.
Yeah. Well, no, no. Hey, come on. How many years have gone by? What's the statute of limitations on horticultural conflagrations? Jeez. Anyway, RC is correct. The blades on some ornamental grasses are razor sharp. Now, you never have to prune these grasses. The clumping types are only going to get wider over time, which may be what you want if you're trying to increase the privacy factor. But, as you know, and hey, who exactly gave me up about the vacation plants? One of the kids? I'm just asking. Anyway, yeah, the old stuff gets dry and brittle and should be removed in dry areas.
Nor, you know, in states where people can easily buy fireworks.
That's it. That's it. You are Jar Jar Binks from now on. Anyway, the old blades make great dry brown material for composting, and removing the dry outer blades does reduce the fire risk, which is serious. But as RC warns, this is a long sleeve, long pants, leather glove adventure.
Okay, but what time of year should this be done?
In late spring, when that new green in the center is about half the size of the entire plant, Jar Jar. Well, those sure were some interesting details about grasses what be ornamental. Now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to set fire to my fountain grass if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location.
Please, please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those questions you are going to ask us. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page and like us. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website sharp. Our associate producer of production association is Brett Rader. Ornamental Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY in Philadelphia. Our editor is invasive Al Banks. I'm innocent, Mike McGrath, and I'll set the world on fire to prove that I didn't set no plants on fire. All right. I said did not set on. Oh, forget it. I'll just call 911, grab the garden hose and a pair of pruners, and see you again next week. What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do. Only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.